Former swimmers looking for a way to give back to the sport in New York City? Reach out to Imagine Swimming. Since 2002, they've been the premier learn-to-swim school with international and American staff, including Olympic champions Anthony Irvin and Eric Vent. Imagine Swimming offers infant to adult classes, plus competitive team options, water polo, and an artistic swimming club coached by an Olympic silver medalist. With flagship locations across Manhattan and Brooklyn, Imagine is always looking for the next generation of swimmers to pass on their knowledge and passion for swimming.
Hey guys, I've been trialing some revolutionary new swim tech, and now you can get your hands on it too. This is EO Swim Better, a swimming evolution in the palm of your hands. Improve your technique with EO Swim Better.
Analyze your stroke technique with EO's Swim Better handset. Go to eolab.com. Use code Brett at checkout and save 10%. We're on, man. Brendan Hansen, how you doing, mate?
Good, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good to see you. Man, what an American legend, man. Finally got you on the podcast.
Yeah, we can give me that, Mike. You can give me that title, but let's not talk about times, okay, or anything that I did in my career, because I feel like watching swimming now, a lot of the racing and the times are exceeding what I did in the pool. But
yeah, I mean, but that's the way it goes, right? In swimming, we should get faster, we should get better, but you're ahead of your time, man. I just watched a race where you went 59.1, I think, and broke the world record at US Nationals, and the rest of the field was a minute 101s, you know, like you were way ahead of the field, almost like an Adam Peaty style type guy in America, where you were just smoking everybody at the time.
Yeah, you know, I think what I remember the most about swimming the 100 breaststroke and was how the crowd reacted when you broke a minute. It was a big deal. It was very similar to when women were breaking a minute in the 100 backstroke, and the crowd would go nuts and lose their minds. So like in my era of swimming, when you saw four numbers instead of five up there, the place went nuts, and it was a huge deal. And so definitely a barrier that was hard to break. And I think it's still hard for athletes to break, but now it's just more readily available, I think.
Who was the first person under a minute?
It was a Russian guy. Oh, okay. Solonov, I think. Why can't I remember his name? But yeah, he went 59.98 or something like that. Okay. And then I know Kitajima went 59.7, and then at trials in 2004, I went 59.3, which was the world record. We both didn't break a minute in the final of the 100 breaststroke in Athens. And then the race you're talking about was 06 in Irvine, where I went 59.1. And then now you can't medal in any international unless you're going under 58.3 pretty much, or 58.0.
Well, you can medal in America. What's going on with the U.S. breaststrokes right now, man? What's happening?
You know, Brett, I think it's like, I think it's not lack of talent. We got plenty of that. I think what's scaring people is the consistency aspect of who we have coming up and who's there, right? So where the reliability of somebody being there, when Cody Miller's on, he's on. When Nick Fink's on, he's on. When Michael Andrews on, he's on, right? And so I think what we're trying to find is just that consistent male that can be in there and race really hard. And I'll be honest, like Nick Fink has really done a nice job. And I think he's somebody that has kind of shown that he can do that. Now, what I've noticed in when you and I were just talking about like the time changes, these guys going way faster in the 100 and way faster in 200, there's such a small percentage. I mean, it's like less than 0.1% of people that can just still do the 100 and 200 at a very high competitive level. Where you saw a lot more of that in my era of breaststroke, where now you're seeing guys specialize in the 100 and really specialize in the 200, although last summer that the 100 and 200 were broken by the same guy, right? But I don't know if we're going to see much of that for a while. I think we're going to see guys focus on one or the other, in my opinion.
No, I agree. I think we're going towards speed and power, where you know you can be more specialized. I think, look, ultimately, if they bring the 50s into the Olympics, which may never happen, but we're hoping it does. But I'm hoping it does anyway. But I think you're going to see more specialists swimmers, and you'll see separation between those 50 breaststrokers, you know, because you see the difference in the body types. You know, those 50 breaststroke men are just like little jacked animals, you know, and
yeah.
And then as they get to the 200, they're a little taller, a little leaner, you know, obviously swimming a little bit more yardage and stuff like that. But you're right.
Brett, let me ask you. All,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious why I'm interested too to see what the IOC does around the 50s as well. So yeah. tell me, I mean, I obviously you're wearing a shirt that says Sprint Revolution, so I know why you want the 50s, but tell me more about why you want the 50s and I'll kind of share what I think.
Well, look, you know, I grew up a 50 swimmer. I wasn't like you. I couldn't swim a 200. It just wasn't in my DNA. I was born to sprint. For whatever reason, in the pool, outside of the pool, I could run an 800, I could do a 1500 on the track, whatever. But in the pool, it just sprinting was my thing. And growing up, whether it just be some sort of complex that I had, but I always had an inferiority complex in Australia. You know, we had the legends, we had Grant Hackett, we had Kieran Perkins. You know, the legends of the 1500 type thing, and that was how Australia was identified. And so if you were a 50 swimmer, you were kind of a joke, you know, growing mm-hmm. up in Australia. And it wasn't, and it still isn't looked upon as a real event. And I took it very personally, but just because that was my event, right? And I've said this to a couple of people. I wouldn't have even known Brendan Hansen if I hadn't have focused on the 50 freestyle, because I had Ian Thorpe. I had, you know, Michael Klim. I had these legends who were swimming the 100. I couldn't compete with those guys. So I would never have competed for Australia if I didn't focus on this particular event and get really good at it. So that was my, that's my passion, right? And you
right. kind of,
and so I see the same thing in the other events where I'm seeing some 50 butterflies and some 50 breaststrokers and maybe even some 50 backstrokers say like, look, I really want to get good at this event, but I can't do it because it's not an Olympic event. You know, and in my event, the 50 free, I could really focus on and get really good at it. And I'm pushing right now to get guys under 21 seconds. I want to see that. But I want to see guys maybe in the 50 breast go under 26 seconds. You know, maybe that's a possibility. So so that's kind of where my passion is on that, I guess. That's where it comes from, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'll take it from a totally different lens. Like my thought is it grows the sport. Like, you know, it gets more people engaged. It gets more excitement around it. I mean, Brett, how many pool decks have you and I been on where it's standing room only for a 50 final of a 50 freestyle, right? Yep. Or we go on a track and it's the 100 meter dash and everybody wants to watch and see who it races. I mean, it has that vibe of a last lap of a car race kind of feel to it when it's the 50. And listen, man, like that as a team captain or as and someone who really did not race those types of races. I didn't know how y'all did it. I was like, this is this crapshoot. And it was what you guys find calm and peace and creativity with those 20 seconds. I saw as like straight up chaos, but I couldn't take my eyes off of it. And right now the world is getting very competitive around sports and who's watching it and who's growing it. And especially around our Olympic sports. I mean, obviously they're creating more space for other Olympic sports. So why wouldn't we just allow the 50s as well, bring in some really fun athletes, you know, grow the sport through that and let's get more people engaged in it. I really don't see a negative in it. And I'll say this, like, it wasn't when I was racing and we saw 50 guys or guys that were specialized in the 50s. I wouldn't say we in the US, we thought of them as jokes. I just never looked at them as like a real true competitor, because to your point, at the end of the day, I was never going to race you in that event at the end. Right. Like, so you could pop off a really, really fast 50 breaststroke time. And I'd be like, well, we still have 50 more yards before somebody's winning the gold. So like, I didn't, you know, it just didn't resonate with me, but I'd love to see it, man. I think it would be something that would, and it would be great if it launched it in LA, like what a great place to do it too. So I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. And I stay out of those conversations. I just do my job.
What are you doing these days? Tell us what you're up to.
Yeah. So, when I left swimming, I went into the business world and got involved in a bunch of stuff, really was pretty successful early. And then I started a club program in Austin and then, moved out of that when we started having kids, and then now I'm with USA Swimming. And so inside USA Swimming, we have a division called Sport Development. And in Sport Development, you have all of our, basically any kid that's not on the national team, junior national team, or national select camp. So it's a, I'm basically in charge of the other 400,000 members, 20,000 coaches, and are basically 2,500 clubs or more. We have a very diverse group of people that work inside. So like all of our programming, all of our resources, all of our coach ed come through there. Why I was so attracted to this position was because I feel forever indebted to the sport of swimming. I think that's why you have this podcast, why you love sharing people's stories, why I see you on my ticker of Instagram passionately on pool decks working with young kids, is that you know the value of what it can do to a human being in their development when they're involved in this sport. And I just wanted to create as much of that environment and opportunity as I could. And USA Swimming had reached out to me and said, what do you think about doing something with us? And it's been super positive up to this point. Everything has its challenges, but when you're dealing with that many people, but I enjoy it. I really like, I'll tell you the biggest surprise in my role that I've noticed is, and we don't give ourselves enough credit, is our club coaches in this country are the best, and nobody realizes it. When everybody goes like, what puts USA Swimming better than any other country in those areas? And like, I'm very aware of what our other countries are doing against us, but just the sheer diversity of an athlete coming into the US and having any opportunity that they want to find the right coach, to find a coach that's going to get them to the next level. I think we are probably the best. And I think a lot of our club coaches are worked so hard in that space that they don't ever have the time to realize how really good they are in developing athletes. And man, I think we have some of the best. And we just, in my role now, is trying to find ways to capture that and then go around and share it out to people and get it out to as many people as I possibly can.
Right.
To make sure that we are just sharing the wealth of knowledge that we have in this country.
Well, you know, on that, I heard through the grapevine that when you were a club coach, you were really good at it. Like there was a lot of people saying that you were good at that and you were getting results. Why did you move away from that? And do you miss it?
I do miss it. I think everyone inside sport development at USA Swimming at some point wants to get back on the pool deck. I think it's an opportunity to step back, grab your perspective, understand what the greater scope of our opportunities are, and then go back into it. Because Brett, one of the hardest things for me is I go to swim meets and I don't ever have a horse in the race, right? Like I don't ever get to, you know, it's great connecting with people and hearing stories and listening and learning. Yeah. And that's where I learned the most, is I learned by asking really engaging questions and finding out what people are doing and not being afraid to ask the hard question. But at the end of the day, I would love to get back out there. And I think probably sometime in the near future, at least with the LA games being as close as they are, wanting to get some athletes to that level. My favorite thing is watching an athlete exceed their own expectations, right? When they do something they never thought they could do, and you're pushing them to that level to where they get it and they see it. And then you just reinforce that, hey man, this is just swimming. It's not your identity. Like you created this opportunity, and you can do it anywhere else in the world you want to do it. In any other facet of your life. And once you make that connection, I mean, a lot of the kids that swam for me at Austin Swim Club are insanely successful in and out of the pool. And I think a lot of that was attributed to the coaches that I had growing up, again, going back to the club coaches, wealth that we have in this country. And then obviously swimming for Eddie for over 12 years. And then listen, I think what most people don't realize is that when I was on the national team for 15 years, I was also rubbing elbows with, you know, our other great coach legends. Yeah. And when you're on that team that long,
I built really
strong relationships, right? Yeah.
We were both lucky. I feel the same way. Like a lot of people say, how'd you get so good at coaching so quickly? It's like, well, I had all these legendary coaches around me. Not only was I on the pool deck with the Australian coaches, but I was watching the American coaches as well. And like when you're traveling the world and doing that, you get to see the best. I mean, I was watching Eddie Reese for years and learning from mm-hmm. him and same as you. I guess I kind of told you I was going to ask you this in the beginning, but I mean, the biggest rumor going around right now is who's going to replace Eddie. Right. And Eddie can't really be replaced. We all know that. No one's going to replace Eddie, but Eddie's stepping down and there's a huge position available. And the name that gets thrown around the most is Brendan Hansen. So it's like, how do you respond to that? How do you feel about that? And is there any truth to that?
I think you're spot on by saying that Eddie can't be replaced. And I think the athletic department knows that. And I think they, I have had conversations with the athletic department in as an alumni and trying to help them understand where they're going. And I've been very encouraged by their awareness of the elephant that they have to now eat and what they have to do moving forward. And I listen, it's the University of Texas. It's a huge brand. It's a huge program. The alumni is really strong. And so I think they're going to do their due diligence and they're going to interview the best of the best. Del Conte, who's the athletic director there, that's what he does. And he's one of the best at it. I think our athletic department at Texas, as again, my experience has totally been as an alumni when with him at the helm, has been super transparent, and he's been out there. And you know, in my conversations with him, has been he's just been like, I'm going to go after the best, and I'm going to go after who I think is going to continue to build the program and hold it to the level of expectation of this entire organization. I'm not going to tell you that I haven't put my name in the hat. It's definitely in the hat. It's there. I would love to have further conversations, but I think at this point, I think they have a very strong pool of people that they're going after, and they're going to figure out what they're going to do moving forward. But
why do you think they're taking so long on this one?
I don't really know the answer to that, Brett. And that's actually probably the biggest question. And I think it's because I think they don't want to screw it up. And I appreciate that. I think they're really doing their due diligence, and I think they're really trying to make sure that it's right. But I think the challenge that they're up against too, and this is solely personal to my experience, is that it is an Olympic year. A lot of the candidates for the job are, women's NC starts this week and men's is next week. You know, you've got trials. So it's a really hard time to have those really in-depth, I think, interviews and conversations. So the timing of a quad and an Olympic Games when you're clearly going after a candidate that is either at a very high level of coaching or is going to be thoroughly involved in the Olympic experience this summer. I think it's going to be challenging to just get a captive audience around this just job position. So
yeah
who knows, man. But from a recruiting perspective, I mean, you of all people know this. They probably want to jump on this sooner than later with, you know, the transfer portal opening up and 26 class being able to be looked at the middle of June. Right.
How would you, I don't know, you can either put yourself in this or take yourself out of it and look at it from the, you know, 50,000 view point, but like, how do you replace Eddie? How do you come in from Eddie? Like, what do you think you would do? Like, do you think you would keep the same things that he was doing, or would you want to like turn it on its head and try some new thing? I don't know. Like, how do you even do it?
I think, you know, here's what a lot of people don't know is I have a very strong relationship with Eddie. He comes over my house every Wednesday night for dinner. And so I've listened to a lot of the challenges and the way he's adapted to, you know, athletic, collegiate sports, NIL, everything. And we have very candid conversations and we talk through a lot of that. And the one thing I can tell you is that he, as I think one of the huge characteristics of a great collegiate coach, or even our club coaches for that matter, are their ability to adjust and shift to what is happening and not making excuses like, well, this generation and these athletes or whatever, but the coaches that can be that chameleon and adapt to what's in front of them and move forward and have the right staff of people to work with to do that. So I've listened to him kind of like maneuver and be nimble and try to figure that out. Even at the age of 84, like, I think his energy level is probably a little bit lower, respectfully. I think at 84, if I was even remotely as active as he is, I think I would be thoroughly impressed. But, you know, one of my biggest strengths is building a team and getting a group of people to buy into what a culture is and making sure that we are in the right path. And what I mean by building a team is just, I'm very good at recognizing what I'm good at and what I'm not good at, and then going after the people that I know I'm deficient in and going and getting those people so that we can be very successful. And so I'm very aware of where Eddie had enough time to learn all of those things. He's kind of, I kind of relay him to like the one man band, right? Like when you see him, he's playing the drums and he's doing the sim and he's playing music and he's playing the guitar and he's doing, and I don't know another program in the country that is operating at that level. And so I have no intention to operate like that at all. I think, again, there's a very, in my experience now where I'm on the phone with 12 to 15 coaches a day talking to them about what they're doing. I would be idiotic of me to not go and recruit the best coaches out there in areas that I know I'm deficient and then go build a badass coaching staff that just can compete against the best. Right. Cause that's what I think a lot of our great college programs are doing right now.
Yeah. Listen, man, I'm going to throw my two cents in here. It made complete sense to me when I heard this rumor, and I've been hearing it for a little while, maybe even when Eddie kind of talked about retirement a few years back, your name was being thrown around, but it even makes more sense now. But like, to me, it had to be an American. It had to be a winner. I mean, you're a winner. It had to be somebody that understood Texas and lived and breathed it and almost, you know, kind of had that relationship with Eddie to kind of know how he ran it and how it might be a little bit different. But so to me, it was like, it made perfect sense when your name came up of like, this just fits so well. And then, like you said, you're talking to all these club coaches. So you've got the recruiting aspect of it. You've got the relationship with Eddie. So, I mean, to me, it seems like a natural, you know, transition. Does Eddie have any say in this at all in terms of when it comes to the athletic department?
I think he said his piece the first time that he retired. just in the aspect of what he wanted in just really making sure that the culture was there. And listen, like when I walked into the athletic department and sat down with Del Conte and his assistant Sarah, and we talked through a lot of this, it was super refreshing to me because I challenged them on, do you really know Texas swimming? Like, right. Do you understand the culture that, you know, you just said, Brendan, you understand it, you get it, you've lived it, you breathed it. And I was thoroughly impressed with how well and fine tuned the athletic department was on knowing that. And I like challenged them because I was like, again, I'm going in as an alumni going like, I got to make sure you know that before you go interview the top, you know, 5-6 coaches in the country on what you're going after. And so that was really my goal. And when they were like, listen, we know it. We know what makes Eddie great. We know what makes the program great. We know it's a marquee program here, and how it affects our other sports. And so, listen, I'm going to get back on the pool deck at some point. I would love to be in some capacity in that realm. But I think, like, going back to my initial statement, like right now they're doing their process and I have to be patient. And it's not my favorite thing to do, but what I can do is continue to be on the pool deck, making a difference and trying to do the best I can. Right. And what's cool is like, I think what I'm most excited about is hearing from all the club coaches that I talk to all the time, just saying like, they're excited about hearing me regardless of wanting to get back on the pool deck. And so that, I think that is exciting to me, because I think that's, that kind of have that support is nice, right? Like I relate it to like when I took 09 and 10 off of the sport after Beijing, and then when I came back in 2011 and swam, like when a lot of my peers were like, dude, it's so awesome to see you back on this, on the heat sheet, and like it's great to see you there. And I'm like, okay, because I mean, listen, nobody wants that job. Nobody wants to follow a legend. Everybody wants to follow the guy that followed the legend.
I know all about that, my friend.
Exactly. I knew I was. Yeah. So let's call a spade here. And I'll be honest, man, like I'm going to rely heavily on my relationships when I get back on the pool deck in some capacity to help me be successful again. I know it's not, I can't do it alone.
Well, man, listen, man, I hope they make the right decision. It makes perfect sense to me. It would be fantastic. I think it would be huge for Texas for you to take over, and I'm a big supporter of it. So, and then if you do eventually get it, which I hope, you and I need to have another conversation in terms of taking over from a legend, because there's some things I learned along the way.
There's no doubt. Yeah. Actually, it's funny because I told Eddie was over my house last night. And we were talking about you, because I told him I was coming on your podcast, and we were talking about it. And he was talking about how the conversations back and forth that you guys were having when you were at Auburn and what was going on there and the challenges that you were up against. And I think just your perspective on the back end and what he was saying, he was like, man, he definitely values what you say in and around the sprint aspect and the way you approach athletes and stuff like that. He just thinks that you didn't have enough time but he spoke very highly of you last night.
I had enough time. I was happy to step down and say someone else can try this now. It's very difficult, right? Like I think the ultimate expectation that anybody's going to walk into at Texas is you need to continue the winning. I mean, that's the ultimate expectation, right? And so when you take over from a David Marsh or even a Richard Quick or an Eddie Reese, the expectation is there's no step back. It's immediate.
There's no rebuild. It's just built on top of what is there.
There's no rebuild. It's just straight into it. And I think that's what people are going to expect at Texas. And I think maybe that's why they're looking at so hard at this in terms of like picking the right person, because they don't want to take a step back. They want to be able to march on and continue winning, and that person needs to be able to do that immediately. Look, I 100% believe you're the guy that can do that, because you were a winner yourself in the pool. You can relate to the athletes. You can relate to all the club coaches. So you're going to be able to recruit. You swam at Texas, so the alumni are going to love you. You know all the alumni anyway. To me, it's a perfect fit. I mean, I could look somewhere else, but you're not going to find exactly what they're going to find in you. And the fact that you have this relationship with Eddie, and Eddie's going to be at your house, and maybe he'll be on the deck with you from time to time or whatever it is, like, to me, that's a perfect transition into the next phase of Texas swimming. So, that's my two cents.
So while I have you and you're on here, let me ask you a question, because I'm really intrigued by this, and I've asked a few other coaches this, but just, how are we getting guys to go so fast yards? Like, how are we? I mean, I can't wrap my head around doing a 50 breaststroke with one stroke and then doing it in 26 seconds. I can't wrap my head around an A relay of 4x100 freestyle that's averaging 40.9, right? Like, I can wrap my head around developing an athlete that says they want to do it and then seeing it through daily to get them there. But there's got to be, like, those are the things that I'm curious about from a tactical perspective. What is the biggest difference you're seeing in it? Let me change my question. What is the biggest difference you're seeing between a 42.500 freestyler and a 40.100 freestyler?
I mean, they're good questions, right? And they're questions that all coaches should be asking themselves. How do we get faster, right?
Tired of settling for less than the best with your team's dry land program? Swimstrong Dryland is the answer you've been looking for. With world-class dry land programming for every age group, customized to fit your team's needs, nutritional coaching and education centered on the latest evidence-based research, leadership training and character development to promote an athlete-driven culture, sports psychology education and mental skills training, coaches' corners to promote collaboration, data-driven performance analysis, and an unrivaled family of athletes, coaches, and teams, fast swimming starts here.
But you mentioned something earlier that I was going to ask you about, and you talked about the first guy to go under 59, under a minute, right? He went 59.9. Right. This is a benchmark, and everybody's looking at this, and Brendan Hansen's sitting back, and he's a minute point, whatever he is, or he's 101 at the time or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then he sees this guy go 59. Well, then the next swim, Brendan Hansen comes out and goes 59.3. So it's like, how do you go from a minute and don't know how to get under a minute, and then you jump to 59.3 because you see somebody do it, right? And that's okay. Ultimately what swimming is and progression in sport is. You see Fred Bousquet go under 19 seconds for the first time, and there's a flood of guys go under 19 seconds. You know, you see someone go on a minute and 100 breast, and there's a flood of people go under. So that's the first thing, right? You have to see somebody do it, but break a benchmark. And then, so yeah, we're seeing guys go 40 point in the 100 freestyle short course yards now. And that used to be mind blowing. But we saw Caleb Dressel do it a number of years ago. And it's like, okay, now it makes sense. Then you start to analyze it. Well, how did he do it? Okay, he did it this way and he did it that way. Then there's obviously shifts in training. So the type of training that you were doing back with Eddie has now shifted, where there are specialists and we are doing a lot more. We're doing a lot more of this type of stuff. We're doing race pace frequently, whereas before for you, it may have been threshold work or VO2 max. Now we're hitting pace in practice. We're hitting race pace in practice. We're hitting speed and power in practice. We're getting stronger in the gym, Brendan. We're doing things that are going to enable us to be more explosive, more powerful, specific training. Our recovery outside of the pool is just, tenfold compared to what it used to be.
I don't even want to talk about you and I did.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really. I mean, recovery for us was like having a quick nap and getting back to it, you know. Whereas now, recovery is part of training, you know. Like you work hard and then you recover hard as well. And so there's just progressions like that. But ultimately, I think it just comes down to seeing people do it and knowing that you can do it. You know, that power of belief and that's where it was, I'm sure. So, I mean, I want to talk about the relationship that you had with Kitajima and the way that you guys brought the best out in each other and pushed each other and how was that relationship early on and how did it develop, the rivalry, that sort of thing. Talk to me about Kitajima a little bit.
Yeah, so that relationship started in 01 when he really came on the scene, and so did I, right? We were in his home country. He, I think, won the silver in the 100 and I won the gold in the 200.
And then Fukuoka, right?
Yeah. And then it really started to take off from there. And I think it was very organic, the relationship. I would say that like we recognized each other's presence. There was a heightened level of like intensity when we would get in the pool or be next to each other. Just like any two competitors, right? Like I would say two alpha dogs walking in the backyard, like they're definitely posturing.
Right.
There was a lot of that. So early in our relationship, it was a lot of that. Like, who are you? What are you good at? What's going on? Are you going to be around a while? My plan is this, that kind of thing.
How old were you at that stage in 2001? You didn't swim at the 2000 Olympics, right?
No, I missed it. Yeah. I was third twice. I think I was 18 or 19. I was 19. 19.
So both you guys were kind of at the start of your journeys, your careers. You're both probably around the same age, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, a lot of the national team folks were showing me a lot of his film, like watching the way he hit his line, the way he did certain things, and they were bringing him up a lot. And I was like, okay, let's study that. Let's understand what he's doing and really figure it out. Because at that point, breaststroke for me was get stronger, get a better kick, be able to deal with the pain longer, right? Like handle endurance and everything. And then he was not built like most. He's 5'9", 180, or maybe like 170 pounds. Like he was not a big dude compared to what the guys are now. But then where it really heated up was 04, Olympic Games. So 03 Worlds in Barcelona. He smokes me in the final of the 100 breast, breaks the world record, goes 59.7. And I remember walking off that meet one, realizing I was a player, like, okay, 2001 Worlds was not a fluke. You're here to stay.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to be fine. You're in the final again. You're vying for medals. Like, there was a lot of validity for me as a high level breaststroker at that point internationally in my mindset. At that point, it was like, okay, let's focus on 04 Olympic Games, going to trials, break the world record, both. And it was just like, I mean, the media blew it up, right? They were just like, here it is, the showdown between Brendan and the former world record holder. And then we raced hard in Athens and he came away victorious. But then I don't think he was planning on me countering. And then in 05, I came back. 06, I broke the world records again. So I think he was kind of like, I won an 04. This was great. The country loves me, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then I just, my actions in 05 and 06 pretty much awoken the monster again. He comes back in 7 and 8. We're racing again. So it was like this back and forth. But I would say by like, you know, this posturing of two alpha males, like it shifted right after maybe like 06 when we'd see each other and I'd broken the world records right after he broke the world records. And it was like, hey man, I recognize you. You're awesome. Let's go. And then honestly, like I would show up at the pool deck every day just going like, he's 8 hours ahead of me. So he's already worked out. So he's already once. So my mindset was like David, even though I was trying to swim like Goliath. And I was just like, every day I was acting like the underdog going like, he's 8 hours ahead of me. He's already done more work than me. I got to keep giving it more. And so like, that was really what sharpened the knife for me in racing him and really just like got me through a lot of the grind, like, and got me through a lot of the time. Cause for, again, my career as a 15, like the 15 years I was on the national team, I medaled in 14 of those years. So the consistency level, I attribute a lot of my consistency to certain people, not necessarily myself, but just having those people that were pushing me, right? Eddie Reese, Kitajima, my own teammates, Aaron and Ian, right? Those guys were just every day. And I think what's cool, Brett, now looking back on my career is like, that's what I admire the most about my career is the consistency level, right? Like that I won NCAAs all 4 years in the 100 and 200. And that's how I justify the times that I'm seeing now versus like, you know, at the end of the day, when kids ask me, they're like, hey, well, how fast were you at NCAAs? I was like, I touched the wall first. That's all you need to know.
I don't need to tell you what
the time was.
Yeah. The times don't mean as much when you're talking about a mindset of a winner. Like even the fact that you brought up that he was 8 hours ahead, that's a winner, right? Like that's a guy that's waking up and saying I'm behind, you know, there's always that saying of like, you know, act like act like you're number one but think like you're number two or something like that. And that's kind of the kind of carried yourself. You always carried yourself like that. Like I'm a winner. Even when you were walking around the deck, I'm a winner, but your mindset is I'm second best. Like I'm fighting for something here. So like you had this killer mindset, you know, and a winner's mind. I love that. I love talking to people about mindset and what makes a winner. Is there anything deeper you can go into that, like in terms of your mindset?
I think where I got really good was when honestly, my long-term development up to the career, up in my career till I got to Texas was really crucial for my longevity in the sport. I think that we could have a whole podcast on just how my club coaches taught me from when I started learning to swim at the age of 4 till I was 18 and recruited and went to Texas. And just how that really positioned me to be successful. I think other countries are doing a phenomenal job of that. What scares me across the country right now is seeing the training styles that you're talking about at that 19 to 21 level of development starting to really bleed down into the club level, when I don't necessarily think that's really where it should live right now in the long-term development of the athlete. We don't have elite 10-year-olds. Like, sorry, there's no such thing. And you don't make the Olympic team at the age of 10. So like, how do we work and develop that 10-year-old to get them there? I think what I try to portray to people, whether you're an elite athlete or you're just a kid in one of my clinics, or, you know, I'm on a pool deck for USA Swimming talking to coaches, it's like, we have this mentality of trying to win workout, And I don't want a win workout. I want to find out where my limits are, and I want to fail in workout. And I think we praise too much the kid that goes a best time in practice, when I would rather see, like, I learned this a lot. Excuse me. I learned this a lot from Pearsall, who would just come in and just, like, I mean, he would banana. He would just go nuts, where he'd go in and, like, Eddie would be like, all right, we're going to descend 1 to 3, excuse me, 1 to 3, 4 to 6 of these 200s. And he'd be doing a backstroke, and, like, where most guys would be like, okay, number 3 is going to be good, but it's going to prep me and prime me for number 6. And I'm going to post a really fast time. And then the crowd, you know, the guys are going to go nuts when I drop a 142 in practice. But what Pearsall would do is he would go as 142 as soon as he possibly could in that set of 6 200s. And then at that point, he was trying to maintain his stroke and his technique and try to find a way to stay at a high level for the rest of the reps that he had. Cause he's like, that's what racing is. He's like, I'd rather fail in practice and win in a meet. And I think what happens is we try to win practice, and then we end up, you know, a lot of times we don't achieve what we think we can in practice. Or I'm sorry, in a swim meet. And that's why you hear on the pool deck all the time, like, I'm faster in practice. I don't get this. I've been faster in practice. And it's like, well, that's your behaviors, man. Like, that's what you created, right? Like, And I tell little kids all the time, I'm like, you got it. I love you, how you dived into the mindset aspect of it. It's like, when I was a kid growing up, the idea of my group when we were 11 to 14 was like, we were a whale pod, right? Like, if we stick together, coach can't hurt us that bad, right? Like, we'll all stay close. We'll all do the set right. We'll check the box and it'll be fine. But what's crazy about that in the aspect of, like, matching up and staying together as a group is that that's the opposite of what you're trying to do in a swim meet, which is stand out, right? I would love to be 2 body lengths ahead of the field and breaking a minute while everybody else is not. But then I remember times when I was swimming for Charlie Kennedy at Suburban where I would do something and I would break away from the group and I would take off, and I was met with negative energy, not positive. Right. At that adolescent age of, you know, 15, 16, 17, when you kind of outlier yourself in a practice and you stand out because you're trying to push that failure limit or whatever it is, well, you're not met with, like, streamers and excitement and, oh man, you're badass and that's great and all. That's not what you're met with. You're met with, like, dude, what are you doing? Get back in line. We're all in this together. Stay on the train, you know? I learned a lot of that, Brett, when I got to Texas. I think college athletics teaches you that, right? I think your time at Auburn, I know you guys had that culture because I raced against you guys.
Yeah, well, I think winning cultures, you know, have that, and Texas has had that for many years. In terms of, and I love the fact that you talked about your training partners. I mean, that they have such a huge influence on you, and the people around you, and the people you surround yourself with is massive. Did Eddie, in terms of the recruiting of you, because you came from Pennsylvania, so nowhere really near Texas, so. When you meet Eddie for the first time, or Eddie's having conversations with you trying to get you to Texas, was it ever a part of the conversation where he was saying to you, you know, I'm gonna make sure that you win, you know, NCAAs for 4 years, you're gonna be the fastest swimmer in America? Like, how did Eddie sell the program to you? Well, it wasn't based on making you this superstar, was it?
No, and I don't know how much of this I want to be truthful in telling you the answer to this, mainly because it's what makes Eddie special. And I'll tell you, because I think a lot of coaches need to hear this, but Eddie was my first call at the time. I think it was like middle of July when you could call, like after your junior year. I think it was July 15th or something like that, or July 1st is when they could call. And I remember being in my house and my mom going like, hey, Brennan, Eddie Reese from University of Texas is on the phone. And it was like, I had just gotten home from practice. It was 9 a.m. in the morning. I remember it like it was yesterday. And he just, the first thing he did was talk to me as a human being and ask me about me as a person, and not necessarily talking about Brennan the athlete, but more as Brennan the person. And I think what I took away from that immediately was, okay, this guy cares about me and potentially wants to see how, like, he was trying to build a relationship versus, can I make you fast? You know, here's what I can do. Bells and whistles, you know, fireworks, all that kind of stuff. And then when I went on my recruiting trip is when I realized that I was being, there's a certain person that can swim at Texas. And then there's a culture at Texas that that you know, resides there. And so Eddie was asking me those initial questions to see if I was even going to be a fit for what they do there. And I again, I don't think it's apples to oranges from other programs, but it's a different apple for sure. If you're apples to apples. And so there was a lot of, that, those types of conversations where it was more, let me get to know you as a person, because I can really understand if my coaching style is going to relate to you and I'm going to get you to where you want to be.
And I
felt a lot of like, I would say comfort and warmth in that, because I, to your point, I was traveling 2,000 miles away from my family and my support staff to go to school. That's a little bit scary for a kid at DHA 18, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. I love that little insight there. And look, I think ultimately a lot of people know that about Eddie. Eddie is, and we're not going to judge Eddie on the sets that he wrote necessarily, right? Like, you're not going to look at Eddie's logbook and say Eddie was so far advanced in terms of the rest of the world and was, and he had all these tricks up his sleeve in terms of writing of workouts. He writes great workouts, don't get me wrong, but Eddie's ability to connect with the athlete is far superior than most coaches living. So that's kind of the key to that. And I think if you were to learn anything off Eddie, that would be the one thing that you'd probably want to take to heart the most, and not say, oh, you know, it's not the X's and O's, you know, it's the relationships that you've built. And the fact that he's still coming over to your house on Wednesday, just, you know, at the age of 84, just goes to show like that's who Eddie Reese is. Like he's coached generations of people and he has lifelong relationships with these people, doesn't he?
Yeah. And I think I'm going to reiterate what you just said for all the club coaches that are listening to you, because I selfishly want to say it is just, we underestimate the connection over content, and nothing will drive me nuts more than being at a, you know, a big convention or a coach's gathering or whatever, and you have our elite coaches up on in a panel or something like that, and it's Q&A, and they go, well, what kind of sets did you give your elite athletes? And I think that I'm like, that is the worst question to ask. You know, I remember, some of the hardest sets that I did at the University of Texas were on paper, to your point, they were just X's and O's,
right?
But it was the guys I was throwing down with. It was the vibe in the whole pool deck. Mm-hmm. It was Eddie and Chris Kubik up there. That was like that connection of like, I am not quitting or I'm going to go harder on this, because I know if I push harder on this, you're going to push harder. And then it was just like it was just going back and forth. And that's that relationship building connection aspect, because the number one question people ask all the time is like, well, how do you build culture on a program? And the thing you got to tell people is like, that is a living, breathing organism. Like, as soon as you think you have culture, you don't have it, or it's diminishing. And you got to keep moving that forward. And I think that was one of the things that our elite coaches do so well, of like gardening or farming it, right? Like, or tending to it. And I think it's not a lost art. I just don't think it's prioritized as highly as it should be when you see all of the content and access coming out. And like, Brett, I'll blow some smoke to you real quick, but just like watching you on the pool deck and watching you engage with athletes, right? You take the time to recognize that they're looking at you. That's hard. Eye contact alone with this group of kids where they all have this in their hand all the time.
Yeah.
And then you slow it down and you say, look, when you get this and you feel that catch, dude, that's it. Like and they recognize it and they go, okay, this guy really wants, like, your energy is going over to them. They're like, this guy really wants me to be good in the 50 freestyle. And they buy into you and they're like, let's go.
Yeah.
That's that connection aspect of coaching that honestly I miss. And I think a lot of developing coaches out there need to polish that skill. And I think the way you do it is by, listen, the wealth of knowledge that we have on the pool deck, you should be walking down the pool deck and asking questions of coaches all the time. And I think you do that, man, you're in the game.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what you said there. And, you know, I always remember Eddie, I was never part of Eddie's team, but Eddie had a way of making anybody feel special or recognized. And Eddie would always come up to me and grab me by the arm. Like he would put one arm on me, just like right here, just grab me by the arm. And then he'd pull me in close and just start talking to me. And I'd be like, this is my competitive coach. Like, you know, I'm trying to beat this guy and he's being friendly with me. He's pulling me in. He's making me feel special. I'm like, I wanted to hate him, but I loved him. You know what I mean? It was like, maybe it was a trick. Maybe he was trying to get in my head.
I'm like, I'm trying to think if it was his mind games. Like that's what he was playing on you. I don't know.
I couldn't hate Eddie, but no.
I think at the end of the day, when he says things like, I didn't do it for the championships, I didn't do it for the medals, I didn't do it for the accolades. I really believe that. I think he saw a platform to develop human beings. And he knew a space where he could really exercise what makes him great. And it was the pool deck and it was swimming. So we're all lucky to have him on the pool deck, and we did, man. So
I
think he gets inspired. I think what I've noticed from my friendship with him is that he is always looking at other coaches for inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where my reaction from a competitive standpoint has always been, you're my competitor. Why am I don't want to talk to you. Right. Like your reaction is my reaction. And then I think one of the things I learned from Eddie when I started coaching was like, you better start. If somebody kicks your butt in the distance events or off the walls, or you got another team that's dolphin kicking and you're not, you better walk over there and ask them, hey, man, what are you doing? Like, you're killing it over here. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons I learned from like a Jack Bowerly, Frank Bush, Eddie Reese, you know, those guys that were pretty much staples in my Mark Schubert. They were all staples in my national team, you know, staff.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I want to touch on your three Olympic golds, your relay wins. I mean, part of just some of the most incredible relays in history. Talk to us. Do you remember who were the four people on each relay, by the way?
Yeah, the 04. Well, yeah. 04 was, let's see. 04 was Pearsall, me, Crocker, and then Jason.
Texas. And who?
And then Jason Lezak.
Oh, they let Lezak on. Okay.
Yeah. we thought we were going to get Neil Walker. Good.
Damn, that
but Jason beat him out by I think a tenth or two and got in there. 08 was I think it was, man, I'm almost positive it was Pearsall, me, Crocker, and then no, I'm sorry, it wasn't Phelps. Crocker, it was Phelps. Yeah, it was his eighth goal medal. And then Lezak, which obviously that was one of those Brett don't screw it up moments, like you know,
that was the eighth medal,
it was literally the last one, which was cool, right? And I think like I really saw Michael there for the first time, like really become the leader that he could be on the pool deck. For a while he's a very introverted person, and obviously he holds a lot to his chest and was really making this run, really built a lot of great friendships on the team. But I think you know, if you watch that race and you see us all march out, we all kind of gather around each other, and he was like, hey guys, look, let's just have fun with this. And I was so stoked because like Lezak's the oldest guy, so you'd expect him to say something. Pearsall and I have been buddies forever. I'm the captain of the team. You'd expect him and I to say something, but it was Phelps who stood up and was like, hey, look, how cool is this? Everybody's watching this right now. Like literally everywhere in the world is watching this race. We're about to make history. And I think it was really cool to see him take the reins of that and run with it. I thought it was really, wow. I'll say it was out of character, but then I think it really launched him into what I saw in 12 and 16 and his ability to lead teams. So it was cool.
Yeah. We individualized training in the pool. So why not individualize your nutrition? Erica Biney of Biney Wellness Building will help you and your swimmers get exactly what each athlete needs through genetic testing and personalized nutrition plans. So stop guessing what you should and shouldn't be putting into your body. Athletes within a few weeks have noticed they're recovering faster because they're fueling their body with what they need and staying away from what their body hates. Erica understands swimming. She gets it. She's worked with over 20 Olympians, including the fastest man in the world, Caleb Dressel. Group discounts are available, so go to Biney Wellness Building and get in touch with Erica today. That's Biney, B-E-I-N-E, wellnessbuilding.net. Let me ask you this about that situation, because I am fascinated with it. I was on the outside looking in, and I got a sense of what was going on as the meet was going on with Phelps, and you could tell on the pool deck there was a shift in the way people were feeling about their chances. You know, as the medal count started to increase and he started to win and he was going from race to race, you could see his competitors just fall by the wayside, like, oh, we got no chance here. And maybe especially when that Kavik, that 100 fly race, when he won by 1/100 of a second, it was just like everyone was done. Like, that was it. Like, we can't beat Phelps type thing. Did you get that sense? Like, what was the inside of it like? Like, watching him go through that and being his teammate and just experiencing that with him.
So there was a lot of talk about it up until the point of when the meet started. And then when he swam the 400 IM and did it the way he did it, we were all like, okay, he's on. So we all knew that he was like, you know, it's one of those things where like, where, you know, what Phelps is going to show up, just like anyone coming off of trials and then going into training camp and coming out of it. I will say though, that like that training camp, unbeknownst to any other one, I felt like he was the most locked in, and him and Bob were just in sync. At least from my perspective, they were in sync. I didn't really dive too much into their conversations, but the third night when they swam the 4x100 free relay and they beat the French. I mean, that was like the first huge, and I'm not even going to say wave, I'm going to say like full blown tidal wave of emotions, to where people were like, whole, like, you didn't even have to be a US citizen to be like, that was amazing. You know, like,
right.
You know, I mean, even Jason, when you talk to him, he was like, dude, I flipped at the 50 going like, we got the silver medal. And then with 15 meters into the last 50, he was like, 15 meters in, he's like, when I went from his feet to his suit, I was like, holy crap, I could do this. And you watched him believe in there. And I think, you know, that's that, like, that's that championship team mentality where certain moments build on themselves during the actual event that ends up leading to like a really great outcome. I think, look, every time he would win a gold, I think the middle golds, like from like 3 to 6, it was not what he did, Brett. It was like how he did it. You know, like the 200 free, he was just like, I'm winning this race. Nobody else is coming anywhere close. And he like dominated from the first stroke.
Right.
And then he like, his goggles fill up on the 200 fly. And he's like, yeah, I don't care. And everybody's like, this guy's like, and honestly, like he wasn't gloaty. He wasn't walking around. Like, he wasn't even celebrating. He reminded me a lot of like Kobe Bryant, like where he was just like, he was laser focused and like, job's not done yet. Job's not done yet. And that was at least the vibe I got from him. And then when he won the 100 fly, I mean, listen, I don't know how many times, I would say like 9.99 times out of 10, you take an extra stroke, you are not winning the race.
Right. Yeah.
And he does it and wins it. And we were like, what? Like, you know, like, and that's when it was just like, this is awesome. And it was really cool to watch and then to be part of the relay at the end and then watch the crowd do what it did. And we kind of, you know, we did the mixing zone, which is when the media is all there, and we came around the corner, and you and I touched on this podcast a little bit about the relationship between coach and athlete. And when Bob and Michael saw each other in the corridor, they just both broke down, and it was really special to be there and see it. And it was awesome, man. I wouldn't say I had much input in it at all. It was really cool to swim with him, because just like I told you, Kitajima would push me in those ways. Michael would say things, Pearsall would say things, Crocker would say, it was just an awesome time to be on the national team, because guys would say things in camp or do things in camp and people wouldn't react negatively. They would just bring more. And they like the culture was just like, oh, you want to go? You want to step up? Lochte would be like, oh, guys, guess what we're doing today? And it was just like, well, okay, looks like we're doing this. And the coaches were like, what do we do? Do we separate them? Do we put them in different pools? Like, should we give them more interval? Like, it was just a really interesting time to be a
member of the team. Right. So you guys are feeding off each other that way. It's almost like a team at Texas where it's like, let's go, boys. Let's bring it. Let's bring the best out in each other. So you had that on Team USA. That's actually pretty rare, because most of the time in situations like that, you got your own separate little groups. You're all doing your own thing, and then maybe you come together for the meet. But at the training camp, it sounds like you guys are pushing each other. Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, there's a you could definitely grab some of those athletes and talk about stories of training camp, and it's pretty funny.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. I don't know how funny it is because we're still not rested from it, but it was definitely. I mean, at one point we did a quadrathlon at Stanford. And it was eight of us. It was me, Mark Gangloff, Michael Phelps, Ryan Lochte, Aaron Pearsall. Who else? I can't. You know who won it? Mark Gangloff.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yep. So it was 50 of each stroke, scored 1,000 points, go into it. Mark was like, this is my bread and butter. He got over there in lane two and just like, and we were at that center course in Stanford.
I love it.
And dude, he just took off and ran with it. It was awesome. Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you this. Are you born a breaststroker, or can you be made a breaststroker?
I think you can be made into a breaststroker in the aspect of being highly competitive. You know, I saw folks like, again, not to name drop, but like folks like Ryan and Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps, who were not born breaststrokers, but really dive into the skill and learn how to do it and do it at a high level. But I think when you're really going to that elite level and trying to get there, there's just a different connection with the water, I would say, than other strokes, a different wiring. Doesn't mean I mean, listen, I've been proven wrong enough times to know not to put anything in the sand, but I definitely was born a breaststroker, definitely felt at peace there and felt like I could express myself the best in that stroke. And then ran with it. Cause I just, there's the things that I would teach other people about the stroke that, had a lot to do with just like how I naturally move through the water and, you know, and I had to like articulate it to get somebody else to understand what I was even talking about, because it came so natural to me. It's like listening to Pearsall or Ryan Murphy talk about backstroke. They're like, man, you just put your hand in the water and you just like anchor it and you like grab it. And you're like, yeah, no, that's not normal. Like normal people don't do that. You know, like they're taught to like, you know, kind of pull and hold the water a little bit differently. Yeah. So, you know, you can always tell when you're at that highest level, when it's hard for an elite athlete to kind of articulate what they're doing in the water to someone who's learning how to do it. And it's kind of fun to listen to them scramble a little bit and try and figure it out. I definitely had to learn that with breaststroke. So I would say that like a lot of the breaststrokers I swam against were kind of born that way.
Yeah. Like I kind of feel the same way. What was your thoughts on Adam Peaty when he came along and started to do what he was doing? What were your thoughts on his technique?
I think he just like leveled up everybody. You know, I had a lot of conversations towards the end of my career with a lot of high level, high performance coaches about tempo and raising my tempo. Yeah. And here's the problem is that I raised my tempo a bunch in races, and with a negative outcome, slipping the water, losing the water. And, I think what we learned from Petey was just a little bit more of that narrower kick, more push back, less sweep around, and not allowing the body to drive into the line faster, getting the head down, which, you know, I think a lot of us at the elite level in that 10, 11, 12 time frame were chasing that. They were understanding that we had to go to a higher tempo. I just think we were approaching it the wrong way, where Petey was the first one to really say like, hey guys, guess what never comes out of the water? Your feet, right? So like, why wouldn't you move your feet faster and let's get our kick stronger? And they really, he did it with like a very leg driven body with a very powerful upper body. And he just kind of like opened the door to a lot of guys that are 6'4", 200 pounds to say, hey, you can swim more than just the 50. And here's how you do it. Yeah. I'll be honest. I would completely change my stroke for the 100 breaststroke now if I came back, just based off of watching the way breaststroke is formed now.
Yeah. I feel like he's kind of in the same spot you were maybe in 2012 going into that last Olympics. Is there any advice you might have for a guy like him, you know, doing what he's about to do, maybe coming up to Paris, in some of the learnings you learned from 2012 maybe?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is the advantage that PD has over anybody else is perspective, right? So I think what I had, you're always looking for your competitive edge when you go to the Olympic Games. And for me, it was, I stepped away from the sport, kind of really figured out who I was, knew what I had going on, understood myself, was really grounded in who I was, took a lot of time and invested more into me, less of my identity being the breaststroker, Brendan, and more focused on that. And then came back in 11 and 12 and just really appreciated the time that I had in the sport. I'm getting the vibe right now. Granted, I'm not talking to him every day or anything like that, but just like, it seems to me like he has that perspective.
Yeah.
And I think that's an advantage where other guys are, you know, 4 or 5 years behind him, where it's like, there's expectation, there's burden, there's whatever. And he's just like, man, I know who I am. I know what I'm good at. Let's go in there and race and let's play the cards the way they lay. And, you know, if I can come out with a medal or I can win this dang thing, then let's do it. And I think that's like the mentality I took into 12, where, you know, I'm in lane 8, I squeak into the final, and I just told the team, I was like, they're going to remember racing me tonight. I don't know whether I'm going to win or I'm going to win medal, but I'm going to make sure that they remember racing me tonight. And, you know, I squeak out a bronze medal out of lane 8 in that final of the 100 breast, which, let's, you know, rewind the tape at back 11 months and everybody says I can't make the Olympic team and I'm not meddling. So it's kind of a good thing. And so, and I'll be honest, like the, now looking back on it, it's my favorite medal of anything I've ever won because of my, my mindset and my perspective and my ability to go in there and execute for the team. And then watching how the team reacted the rest of that session, we won 6 Olympic gold medals the rest of the meet. Or the rest of that night, which was awesome. So those are the kinds of things that I think PD can do. Is I think, you know, Great Britain is a force as a country. They're really coming on strong. And I think he's somebody that can lead them with example. He doesn't have to win to be that guy. I think a lot of people think that, but he doesn't. He can go in there and just execute at a high level and really make sure he leaves at the right place when he walks off.
Yeah, good advice, man. Well, listen, I appreciate your time. A couple of things. I hope they build a statue for Eddie at Texas out the front of the pool. They need to do that. And then I hope you're the next head coach at Texas, man. I really do. I think they'd be making the right decision if they picked you. So good luck with all that, man. I hope and either way, you're going to have a huge influence on USA Swimming either way. So I'll see you out at the trials, man. I'll be there.
Cool, man. I appreciate it. That was a great talk, man. It was good to catch up with you.
Yep. Take care, buddy.
Thanks, man.
Bye.